All right, welcome everybody. We are on Rus, third Perek, and we're at the 15th verse. That's 3:15, Gimel Tes Vav. And we're really far in now, and we're talking about how Boaz has acquiesced to marry Rus Vayibam. And he sent her away to go back to Naomi, and that's his business, how he's got to give tithe out the way. It's not so straightforward. It would be very, very straightforward if it wasn't for the fact that there's another redeemer in the way, who's Elimelech's brother, tithe. Got to get rid of that problem. Only reason we're getting rid of him is because, first of all, Rus chose Boaz as the more spiritually potent redeemer for Machlon's sake. And two, for Gilgul Tikkun reasons, we've got all kinds of reasons why we'd prefer Boaz to do it than anyone else. So Boaz is aware of that, and he's now got to make this work. Essentially, Rus's job is done. She's worked as hard as she can, getting all the way from being a Moabite princess to asking Boaz to legally marry her under the concept of Yibam and Redeemer. Her work is done. Now we're literally shifting gear, and it's Boaz's job to make this happen. Let's look at verse 15. V'yemar Havi. And then he said, hand me the shawl that you're wearing and hold on to it. That's interesting. She held onto it, and he measured out 6 measures of barley. And it says, V'yoshes aleha v'yavoya ha'ir. He set it upon her, and they went, V'yavoya ha'ir. V'yavoya ha'ir is in the masculine. It literally means, and he went to town. Now, we would never have thought at all the word vervahir would make any sense whatsoever. It should be vatovoya ha'ir, and she went to town. Why are we referring to Rus in the masculine? So there's quite a lot to discuss here. This is another one of the crux moments in Rus, is this 6 measures of barley. This is really key. These bundles of barley. What is going on? Why did he do this? There seems to be absolutely no necessity for this whatsoever. She should just go back to Naomi and sit tight and let him work his magic at court. Why did he do this? Now, Boaz believed that if she returned from town empty-handed, the suspicion of the inhabitants would be aroused. And they'd think that she remained only overnight if they could see that she returned with the previous day's gleanings. And that would show that she'd never gone home and then returned to the threshing floor at night to meet with Boaz. However, here's the plan. If she returns empty-handed, they would wonder what she'd been doing all night. So in an attempt to prevent those thoughts from going through people's minds, he filled her shawl with 6 measures of barley, which is 6 se'ahs worth, as we learned about much earlier on. That's quite, it's about, you know, 20 or so more litres of barley, which is quite a large amount of barley, a significant amount of barley. So that's crazy. He poured that into this, so she held out her apron, and there was poured into that gap loads and loads of barley. She would be walking around with this huge amount of grain to walk home with. Now, the Medrash Rus Rabba 7:2 talks at length about the number 6 and what's going on. We'll talk about that in a minute. In the meantime, putting the 6 concept aside, but just talking about the fact that he gave her barley at all, Boaz was afraid that Rus would be accosted on her way to town, because if she returned empty-handed, she'd be mistaken as a harlot. Now that she was given a bundle of barley, it would be assured that she'd picked a huge amount the day before, and that the weight of the stalks would have slowed her down to such an extent that it would have become night and she couldn't have come home. People would have thought that she had continued gleaning right until sunset and had no alternative but to stay on the threshing floor. No one would have suspected that she had returned there at night after taking her gleanings back to town. So this is a very safe way to get her back to town without any dubious thoughts. Now, why is it we need that? Why is it we need no one to think a bad thing about her? Rus is the only one at stake here. As we learned last week, Boaz's righteous status was known to everybody. No one's going to think Boaz was up to no good. The only reason he's doing it is for her sake. People would think she was up to no good. So to spare her the distress, he did this. Now, coming back to the words in 3:15, Vaya Vaya Ha'ir, last two words, and he went to town. What's that? And he went to town. It should be for Tavoya, and she went to town. What's going on? So Bereshis Rus Rabba 7:3 talks about this as well. Again, there's all these at length things, but I'm going to just crunch it down. But this is really important. According to Rus Rabba, the Medrash Rabba on Rus, it says that Boaz actually accompanied her on the way back to town to ensure her safety. So he walked with her. That's one opinion, that he went with her. And he went to town along with Rus. However, wasn't he afraid of the reaction when people would hear that Rus had lain next to him during the night? How could Boaz allow himself to walk with her? So it's like this. Boaz's instructions to Rus seem very inconsistent. At first, he told Rus, if you have a look, to hand him her shawl. Then he told her to hold it. Who's holding the shawl? Now, this is presumably because he needed both hands free to measure the 6 se'ah of barley and pour it into the shawl. Why then did she have to hand him the shawl in the first place? He should have said, remove your shawl and hold on to it. More than that, it says she held on to it. It says she held on to it. That confirms that Rus followed his command. And it should have also related that she gave him the shawl as she was instructing to do. But it makes no mention that she gave him the shawl. What exactly happened here? And why do we need to know? The Medrash explains the word she held it as meaning, she girded her loins like a man. They were both wearing, in those days, they both kind of wore blanket-like garments. And she decided to tie up her belt in the manner of men, not the manner of women. The Medrash supplies the meaning as to what's going on. She tightened her belt, as would a man, and then slipped the two ends of her shawl into the belt so that her hands would be free to hold up the other two corners. So she tied up the sheet, the shawl that she used to carry to put the barley in, at two corners on her belt. And then she held open, like a sheet, like a bag, the other two sides to make a receptacle for all this 20 litres of grain. This makes sense? Boaz was then able to pour the barley into the shawl unhindered. Now, why else would she gird herself like a man, says the Medrash? Anyone looking at their direction from a distance, especially at night and in early morning, would have thought Rus to be a man because she was now dressed like a man, wearing her belt and her clothing like a man. And that means no one would pay attention to her. It's just two men walking down the road. Boaz asked Rus to hand over her shawl. Since he was a man, he could tie it to his belt, and while she held the other two ends, he would pour barley into the shawl. But Russ did not want Boaz to go to the trouble of holding it and pouring in the barley. And also, if she would have had her shawl tied to his belt, it would seem immodest. It's quite unsneers to do that with this man. So she slipped the two ends into the belt that she had tightened around her waist, and she just held it. So instead of having anything to do with him, she's a totally self-like standing structure, and he's just pouring barley into that shawl. And that explains why the pasuk doesn't relate that she handed her shawl to Boaz, because she didn't. She held it herself so that Boaz has his hands free to pour the barley in. So you can see how unimaginably sneers Rus was. Since the time she told him to spread his cloak over her, she had remained totally silent and didn't speak another word until she returned to Naomi. She hadn't said one extra word. The last thing she said is, "You're my redeemer." That's the end of the conversation. Then he said, "Go home." Let's look back at the pasuk again. Then he said, "Hand me the shawl that you're wearing and you hold on to it." She then held on to the open two sides, and he separately measured out 6 measures of barley and set it upon her, because she was the one carrying it. She set it upon herself like a man, and the two of them went to town. That's why it's in the masculine. Next verse, 16. This verse is huge. I would even think about getting a pen and paper here. I've not said that from chapters 1, 2, and 3. This verse, 16, has 3 totally different interpretations. And we need all 3. So I'm going to need you to hold cop on this. I would even make notes. I haven't said you to make notes. On this one verse, make some notes. There's so much potting here. Think about what's happened. The whole thing's happened. Everything's happened to her. She gets home, and Naomi is like, "No. Like, what's pshat? What's happening? What's going on? You've got to fill me in with the news." Right? So that's very, very important here. This is the one short verse where suddenly everything's got to be related to Naomi, and it's done so in very, very tight language, which means a lot's happening with a little words. So I'm going to have to open this up for you. Let's look at this. V'tavoy el chamoisa, and she came back to her mother-in-law. V'tomer, and her mother-in-law Naomi said, "Mi at biti." Now that's usually translated as, "How are things?" How does Art Scroll translate it? Verse 16. She says, "How do things stand with you, my daughter?" I don't know how you've got it translated, but "mi at" does not mean that. "Mi at" means, "Who are you?" Feminine. "Mi at" means like, "Who are you?" And then she says, "Biti." Now I've got news for you. If a guy knocks on your door and you go, "Who are you?" You don't go, "Who are you, my son? Who are you, my daughter?" If he's your son or your daughter, you know who they are. She said, "Who are you?" "Mi at" means, "Who are you?" "Biti, my daughter." All right, something's up. Something's up. "V'teged lo eis kol asher lo ha'ish." So Rus told her everything the man had done for her. What did she said? She related the matter. What's going on? This pasuk is very enlightening and starts to meld together a lot of what we've said right from the intro in the beginning of section 1. So I want you to really strap in for this one. This is... Right from the beginning, I've been telling you that it always says, "My daughter-in-law, my daughter, my daughter-in-law, you're my daughter." How many times do we need to be told this? Yet again, Naomi's calling her Biti. Why do we not know that Ruth is her daughter-in-law? What's potting here? Notice Naomi's name's not mentioned. She is simply identified as a mother-in-law. Why? This is whenever Scripture's doing this, it's emphasizing her exceptional piety. Any normal mother-in-law would feel sad if her daughter-in-law marries another man after her son's death. Now, she knows Shoni sent her there to get engaged to another man, which will essentially divorce Rus from her. And yet, she calls her Biti, my daughter. That's exemplary. But she said, "Me Ut, who are you? There are three ways, totally separate, mutually exclusive ways to translate these two words. Here's number one." I would write this down. Interpretation Aleph. Who are you? Are you single or are you engaged? What's your status? If you're single, you are still my daughter-in-law. If you are engaged, you're someone else. Me Ut. Who are you? Where are you holding? What's your status? Do you understand? That's Pshat Aleph. That's basic interpretation number one. Do you understand? Is everyone comfortable with this? Now, she added my daughter because she looked forward to hearing that Rus would marry soon, like a loving mother wants to know that her daughter's going to get engaged. But the Mia is, where are you holding? Are you holding online with me or are you holding offline with me? What happened with Boaz? Now, Rus was in a quandary because the truth is, she doesn't know. She knows very little at this stage. Now, she thought as follows. If I tell her that I'm married, that's not quite total truth. And we know previously when she didn't give over complete truth, she's called the Moabitess as an insult. When she didn't give over the full truth, she'd learn her lesson. She's got to give over the full truth. So it's not fair for her to say, well, you know what, nishtahi, nishtaher. She can't say yes or no to that because yes or no, neither of those are true. But she can't say she's single either because Boaz has said, I'm on my way to sort out marrying you. So she can't say she's single. She can't say she's married. She can't answer Naomi's question whether or not she's single or engaged. She doesn't know. What happens if Toiv does or does not wish to marry me? She feels as if she's almost married. And if she tells Naomi that the chances are, even at the moment, I don't relate the whole story from the beginning to end, she'll think that Boaz is pushing me off, not wanting to embarrass me. If she says, I don't know, we'll have to see. I can't answer your question. What's Naomi going to think? Naomi's going to think, this didn't go well. Think about it. Imagine you were Naomi and you ask, no, and you say, I don't know, which is true. You'll be thinking, oy vey, how bad is that? If she says that she is married, you can't just crack open a Mazel Tov. We've got Toiv in the way and we don't know about maybe Boaz is going cold in the interim. The bottom line is, the only way to make matters clear for Naomi's question is to relate the whole kit and caboodle of every single word Boaz said. That's why it says, the taged lo eis kol asher asa lo ha'ish. She had to relate everything that had happened to make it clear what's going on. When Rus finished relating all of her experiences of that night, she then explained the reason for bringing all this barley. Remember, I've not lost what's going on, the three interpretations of me at. I've got to explain what's going on. We're going to go to verse 17 to explain the other two understandings of me at. Me at, who are you, is very much still up for grabs. Me at number one is married or engaged. What's your marital status? That's Pshat Aleph. Pshat Beis and Gimel, we have to go to 17. Now 17 contains something called a Ksiv Kri. If you have a look, it should be in a good copy of this. You should see there's a word that's written with vowels which is what we say. And there's a word that's actually written in the scroll of Rus that we don't read. And instead of reading the word that is actually printed, we read another word which isn't printed. And you only know to do this according to rabbinic tradition. So if a Reformed Jew or a Gentile were to open a scroll of Ruth, they would see the word that's written and say it like that. And we would say, no, that's the wrong word. There's a written and there's a pronounced. Ksiv, written, kri, lained. Are you with me? We got to go through the ksiv, kri. We got to understand what's going on and what's happening. Why is one word written and another word said? Every time that happens, there's always something to learn. There's always something to learn. I'm going off. Come with me. It'll be great. You'll love it. Where in the Torah do we see more ksiv kris than anywhere else? In fact, in one place, there's more ksiv kris than anywhere else added together in the entire gamut of scripture. That's right. 10 points to whoever said it. Eicha. Lamentations. Why is that? Here's a story. A story. Once upon a time, in a country far, far away, there was a man that had married a woman. And unfortunately, she died young. And when it came time for her burial, he made a hesped, a eulogy for her. And he extolled her virtues beautifully. And all around were impressed to hear the amazing stories of this woman and how fantastic she was. A year later, when the mourning was finished, the man went to his father-in-law and said, listen, you have another unmarried daughter. You're already my father-in-law. Please, may I marry your other daughter and we'll start again. And he said, nothing doing. And he asked why. He said, because if you truly loved my first daughter, there'd be no way you could have eulogized her so eloquently. When God told Jeremiah to write Lamentations, he gave him over a very specific set of words. And there are so many ksiv kris in there, it teaches us that God was stammering over saying the prophecy over out of pain to have to do this to his own children. So instead of eulogizing the girl and saying, what a wonderful woman, what a balas chesed, if he really loved, he'd be like this. I can't imagine life without her. Each one of those ksiv kris by Jeremiah in Eicha is a stammer, as it were, that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is exiling his beloved. That's why Eicha is littered with more ksiv kris than anything else, each one to learn something by. I'm back on our ksiv kri. We've now got verse 17, which is going to illuminate verse 16 in the me'at thing. V'tomer sheish hasa'irin. And she said to Naomi, he gave me 6 measures of barley. Sa'ar is barley. 6 measures of barley. Ha'ela. That's very interesting. These 6 measures he gave me. Look, visible. Look at these 6 measures. Now suddenly, ki amar, for he said to me, here's the ksiv kri. We say the word Eli, to me. Now that's hidden. We say it, but it's not written. While it says, V'loi, al tovi reikam el hamoseich. Do not come empty-handed to your mother-in-law. So I'm going to read it without the ksiv kri, and they're going to read it with the ksiv kri. She said, he gave me these 6 measures of barley, for he said, don't come empty-handed to your mother-in-law. Or, he said, he gave me these 6 measures of barley, for he said to me, Don't come empty-handed to your mother-in-law. Now, excuse me. What big difference does that make? So what? Why go through the bother of a cassive crate? To me, it's like nothing's been added. It's you could have saved the ink. Just leave it the way it was. What's going on with... Do you hear? It doesn't seem to be adding any data. Are you with me? This is where it gets interesting. Now, previously, she had answered any queries that Naomi might have had about the previous night. And the verse begins, 17, with the word for timer. She said, denoting this was not a continuation of her main story, but additional details she wanted to relate to Naomi, to fill in the gaps, to make sure Naomi gets the right end of the stick. The verse does not begin by saying, and these six measures of barley, etc. Because if it did, it would seem as if she's basing her whole story on the thing of the barley. And the barley's got nothing to do with this, as we'll see. She made it clear that no conclusions should be drawn from the barley given to her by Boaz, because it has no bearing on the story whatsoever. It's something additional that's personal, a lie to me. That's got nothing to do with what's being discussed. Everything I've told you, I was there. He said to me, I held his hand. I said, I grabbed his ankle. I said, you're redeeming me. That was it. Then he told me this whole thing and what we're going to do, etc. And what I've got to do. Oh, by the way, this all this barley, it's mine. It's to me. It's got nothing to do with anything he has said about this whole marriage business. This is a separate inion entirely. Now, she said, he gave me nosan li. Notice there's asnachta, like a wishbone, which is the trop for a comma after the word li. Can you see that? I don't know whether you've got the, if you look at the trop sign under the lamed, it's a little like a wishbone, and that wishbone is the cantillation that the person leaning in to say ha'ele nosan li ki amar ela. That li means stop. It's a pause, which means it's to me. So we're learning out from the trop. This is very. She's saying he gave this to me. He said I shouldn't come to my mother-in-law empty-handed. This is a totally separate concept. There is no evidence that he's rejected me. On the contrary, I'm going to be married to him and I'm going to be separated from you. The barley is a gift given so that I should not return empty-handed to you. It's not any compensation for embarrassment. Like, you've had a really hard night, love. It's been very difficult for you getting here. I understand the difference. Let me give you a gift to sweeten the deal. Take back this barley and you can eat. This is a gift from him to me personally. Just as a man who leaves his home to visit God in the base of Migdash is forbidden, Mudaraisa, to turn up empty-handed. Says you will not turn up empty-handed. You've got to come with whatever God's blessed you with. You must appear with a gift in the honour of God. And that's a Mudaraisa that's in Devarim 16:16. That's 16:16. And it's also in Shemais 23:17. So too, I'm presenting myself to you with a gift, because I found a home with a new man and I'm only coming to visit you. I'm visiting you now. I'm already another man's wife. I've got my own home. Don't ask why today should be different. Boaz has given barley to me, a lie, so that I should have something to bring to you, like any visitor turning up to someone's house with a gift. I'm a visitor. That's another me at. I'm a visitor. Who are you? I'm a visitor. That's another me at. I'm giving you this gift as a gift to anyone that would knock on your door and not turn up empty-handed. A bottle of wine, bunch of flowers. Hey, you want barley? I got barley. Now, if this is so true, how come Boaz said, Al tovia reikam el chamoseich, don't turn up empty-handed to your mother-in-law? If it's so true that you've got nothing to do with me anymore, how come he referred to you as my daughter-in-law? Answer is, he agrees that the soul of Mahlon is within me and therefore we're still connected. What you said about him is true. He's indeed perceptive. Now, there's another way you could go back to me at Biti in verse 16. If you'd come empty-handed, I would have no doubt you'd been accepted by Boaz. But I see that you've come back with a lot of barley. And I wonder if your relationship with Boaz last night was far closer than you've told me about, and he's paid you for something. So when she says, me at, and she sees all the barley, one way is, who are you? Are you a harlot? Who are you? You're my daughter? This is how you behave? Bringing back the money from this? That's another me at. Do you hear this? What, you got the money back? You better explain yourself, girl. That's, you know, it's that kind of lotion. What do you think you're doing? Bringing disgrace upon yourself and me? Who are you? You're my daughter. Should be behaving like this. Totally different chat on me at. The first one was, are you single or engaged? The second one is, where are you holding? Like, I'm a visitor. Who are you? Like any visitor, who are you? Another one is, are you a prostitute? Is this your fee? Not at all. We've got another one coming in as well. Now, Rus was in another quandary. If I tell her the truth, that Boaz said nothing to me when handing me the barley, she'll certainly assume, because I haven't said anything to him, she'll certainly assume that it was a fee. However, even if I tell her that he gave me the barley to me, for her sake, I for Naomi's sake, because she's a relative, she'll be sceptical because Naomi has a way, he's quite distant from Boaz. So if she'll think I'm lying if I tell her the truth. Therefore, Naomi had to tell her everything, back to verse 16, that had happened that night, from the time he told her that her present act of kindness was greater than her first. And now she's attempting to preserve the spiritual life of Mahlon, while previously she'd been concerned only with material needs. Once Naomi heard that, she'd see that Rus held Boaz and Boaz held Rus in equally high esteem. And she acknowledged the chesed that Rus was doing. And therefore, the prophet writes, Shmuel writes, he gave me. The entire verse is a story in itself. The reason she had received 6 measures of barley was not connected to anything that's happened so far. It's Eli, it's to me. Why? It was given solely that she should not come to her mother-in-law empty-handed. But there's another way to understand it. Rus told Naomi his whole intention of giving me the barley was an allusion to the fact that I am going to be blessed with 6 super righteous descendants. The barley's irrelevant. The number 6 is the key. The only thing that was to hand was barley. So he gave me 6 measures of something. It could have been anything. It could have been potatoes. It could have been candy. It could have been 6 light bulbs. It was whatever was on the shelf. But he had to give me 6 because 6 is the number of descendants I'm going to have who are going to be luminaries. Didn't have to be the barley. The barley is irrelevant. That's why the word Eli, to me, is omitted from the text. Boaz did not disclose the reason why he was giving her 6 measures of barley. He kept it to himself. It was almost Kabbalistic. He was like, he was saying, hold out your shawl. Why? Just do it. And he put 6 measures of barley in to already give the brocha of 6 over to her. Irrelevant of what the actual material was. Now, it's possible Rus meant to say, don't think that the barley was intended as a gift for me. He gave me only 6 of them. And they're merely barleys. They're not particularly expensive. Also, he gave them to me by lifting them onto my shoulder and didn't present them to me as any kind of marriage dowry. This is not nadunya. This is not dowry, wedding accoutrements. It's an important message. A man as rich as Boaz would never give such a paltry dowry as 6 measures of barley. The word li, to me, says he was hinting that from me, 6 will issue. So now let's go back. Oh, okay, last thing. Who are you? Mi at. I've got to finish this off. Mi at. Who are you? You know, it's like this. Some people, I often get people asking me questions. They want to find out who they are, so they need to go to a Makubal. They want to go to someone who studies Kabbalah. And they feel as if, I don't know why, people feel as if Mukubalim are like prophets. They're magicians or wizards. That, you know, you go there and they'll read your face and they'll tell you you've eaten too many bananas and you're born under the wrong sign or something. It's not true. They're just Torah scholars who are in a particular... But people see it like that. And people go there because they want to know who they are. Boaz seemed to be one of these people. You go there and he'll start telling you who you are because he's one of the chief Sanhedrin judges. It's like going to see, you know, one of the Gadoli Hador. Maybe he'll tell me something about me. You know what I mean? Says Naomi Mi'at. Who are you? Maybe Boaz has cottoned on. Are you just some Moabites? Or are you the good dove of Moab? So she now says, it's to me. I know who I am. I've got it. It's to me. I know I understand who I truly am. I am Lot's daughter. Let's go back to Mi'at. Let's go back to Mi'at. Who are you? That's verse 16. Then she came to her mother-in-law who said, who are you, my daughter? Number one, are you engaged? Are you not engaged? Number two, are you my daughter-in-law or are you a prostitute? Number three, you're a visitor. Just stum a stranger bringing me a gift of barley. Number four, who are you really? Answer, I'm the reincarnation of Lot's daughter, and now I know it for sure. You've been telling me this for a while, but I didn't really know it as much as I know now, and now I know who I am. You're asking me who I am? I finally found out. And Naomi wants confirmation of all this. So one is, she's engaged. Two is, she's not a prostitute. Three is, she's a visitor. Four is, she's the good dove of Moab. All that's coming out of Mi'at. Two words. You've got to be holding on a lot of the ideas of the themes of Rus to understand what Mi'at means. There's a lot of things cooking in that for you just to be able to understand what Naomi's even saying to her. Verse 18. Gosh, we're storming through it. End of the third perek. 3/4 of the way through at this verse. You should give yourself a pat on the back. All right, it starts getting intense here. For Tomer, she said that he is now... She said she's carrying on the report of what's going on. So she said, who's she? She said, Shvi Biti, literally sit calmly. Sit, my daughter, until you find out how things are going to turn out. For the man will not rest until the matter is settled today. Yipol Davar. That literally means the word will fall or tumble. It seems, from my learning of these verses that we can gather the emotional state of Rus at this stage. I'm reading into this. I've not seen this anywhere, but I think it's fair to say from what we're about to learn, it's not a jump of the imagination. I think Rus is getting overexcited, jittery, and nervous because of the intensity of what's going on. I want to say she's starting to panic, but she's going a bit hyper. That's what's happening. It's like, and suddenly Nami jumps in, says, calm down, stay the night, don't worry, the whole thing's going to fall into place, you stay with me. Now, I don't feel as if it's a far stretch, and I'm going to have to back that up, because I'm picking that up from acupuncture, throwing that to you. Let's see what the Alshech HaKadosh says on this pasuk. It seems very clear that Naomi in this verse is calming Rus's nerves. And it seems, according to the Medrash, that Rus is even accusing Naomi of ruining her life at this stage. Essentially, she's come back not really knowing what Boaz is going to do. Let's say he goes cold on her. Let's say Tov marries her instead. Or let's say Tov doesn't marry her. She's going to end up a spinster and lost forever. And this is all on Naomi's plot. And she starts to panic about what could happen. And it's all your fault! You told me to go and I did it! It's all happening to me! I've just found out who I am and you're calling me a prostitute! It's all a bit much. And Rus starts to lose it. Naomi's like, don't worry. It's going to be okay. You yourself told me that Boaz has asked you to remain with him overnight. And in the morning, he'd see whether or not Tov wants to redeem you. That's the whole plot, right? There's no reason to panic. Even if a whole day passes, if you've not heard from anything, don't lose hope. Calm down. Calm down, says the Alshech HaKadosh. He's telling to calm down. And even if the day's not over, don't worry. If a day, 2 days, 3 days, don't worry. There's a possibility that Boaz didn't inform Rus of the outcome. He might have felt it was more dignified if he came personally to marry her a few days later. So he'll take his time. However, during that time, Rus would be panicking. She doesn't know. There's no texts. There's no email. There's no telegram. She's just alone, waiting. Maybe Boaz's enthusiasm for her has calmed down after thinking about it for a day or two. It's crazy. He's an old man. She's a young woman. What was I thinking? Naomi was reassuring Rus. Don't think that he's rejecting you, even if it seems that you acted despicably by lying at his feet. Because as far as this is concerned, let me assure you there is nothing to worry about. The only doubt that remains with you is how you are going to be settled. That's why it says, Yipol Davar. The matter will literally fall. Either you're going to fall into Boaz's lap or Tov's lap. Either which way, you're going to get remarried. Someone's going to marry you now. Whatever the outcome, we're going to find out by the end of the day. Now, the word Shvi Biti, the Alshech says, is sit calmly, my daughter. Because Shvi is from Shuva, found in Isaiah 30:15, B'Shuva V'Nachas, in ease and rest. So it's very understandable. The Shvi Shuva literally sit calmly. Very interesting halacha. If you find a lost object, the Torah enjoins you to return it to its owner under the mitzvah of Hashavas Aveda. And it is for you to give the object back to the person who lost it. That's why it says in Kiddushin 2b, it is for a man to go look for his wife, because a wife has a din of a lost object of a man, because woman was taken from man. Isha was taken from Adam. So she's a bit of him, he's got to go find it. It's down to him to go find her. If you have a lost object, you've got to find the owner. The Gemara in Sanhedrin 31b says, unusually, with a Yavoma, she is bound to have to follow the Yavam, the man who's going to redeem her, even to his own hometown, even if she's in Tiberias and he's in Spheris. That's like the whole country away. That's like London to Glasgow. Get on a train. Hold on. Isn't it for a man to find his wife? No, you're a Yavoma. You've got his lost object in the soul of the husband that you've got in your belly. You've got to return that to him. Rus has done all she has needed to do. Her game is up. She was in Moab. She married Mahlon. Mahlon died. She's now left her homeland, walked barefoot from Moab to Bethlehem. She's living in destitute, grinding poverty with her mother-in-law. She's found a redeemer. She's got the redeemer. Job done. You've done all you can in this story. There's no more for you to do here. It's over. I've got news for you. Boaz has to make his move. You sit down, literally put your feet up and just wait. There's nothing more you can do in this situation. You've found the Yavam. He says he's got to do his bit. There's no more you can do now. There's no more. All you've been doing is being active in this whole story for three chapters. If you read the script, it's three chapters of Rus getting active. Now it's time for you to sit down. Now it's time for you to be passive and let Boaz do his thing. Yipoil hadova. Literally, the word will tumble from Toiv's mouth as to whether or not he's going to redeem you or Boaz is going to redeem you because Toiv is going to reject you. That's what Yipoil Dover means. And if he says, no, I can't take her, then that's it. That's the end of the, that's it. You're done. This, in fact, is a certainty, Rus is being told by Naomi. The only thing lacking now is how it's going to work. Until now, the spirit of Mahlon has been restless inside of you. And this has spurred you on to find a mate, which you have now done. Now the onus is on Boaz, and since he seems very eager to marry you, he won't rest, being spurned on by his desire to redeem himself in this situation until the matter is settled. So let's just do a bit of a recap. Mahlon's spirit has done all it can do to encourage his host, Rus, to find some kind of suitable redeemer to come back into this world. She herself, Rus as an individual outside of being a host for Mahlon, has put the boat out in going to Boaz in the middle of the night because she's Lot's daughter and she wants to be Metaken her element as well. There's two things that Mahlon is striving. Rus as Lot's daughter is striving. Naomi as Mahlon's mother is striving. And now, having done her bit, Boaz stroke Yehuda, who's a Gilgal of Yehuda, fixing up what's going on with Tamar, is going to be as driven to get this done as you and Mahlon have been to get to the state you've got to now. You know how hard you've worked. The same forces will be at play in Boaz. And just like you've worked hard, he's going to work hard. And he's a man of means and resources and influence. He's going to get the job done. It's like someone making a sales pitch with the top company. You know what I mean? Like, I don't know, the chairman of a top company. And they've literally come from nowhere to sit with the CEO of a multi-billion pound conglomerate. And they got a business idea. And you know what? He likes it. Years of slog. I remember, years ago, two teenage boys who invented something called YouTube were at a meeting with Google, and these two boys, offered $8 billion to sell YouTube to Google. Sold! You can believe it! They can believe their luck! They had worked and worked and worked and worked, developing a completely new platform which was going to change the world. And then suddenly they got to like these top Google guys who were saying, leave it with us. We're gonna launch this rocket. That's where Russ is at. She's come from nowhere. She's made her sales pitch to the top CEO spiritually in all Knesset Israel. Leave it with him. Go home, have a cup of tea, chill out, and let him do the rest. The Sanhedrin members will organise this legally perfectly. You've done your bit. All of chapter 4 is how legally Boaz organises this changeover. When we do chapter 4, we're going to do the first 4 psukim as a block. And then we'll take the next 3 to 5 psukim as a block in and of themselves. Essentially, we're all tying up loose ends. And that concludes the 3rd chapter. Does anyone have any questions they want to ask on anything we've done so far? Yes, Clive, unmute your microphone.
Normie and Ruth are there when they're redeeming. They've got land that goes with them, yeah. Because so why are they classed as paupers if they actually own land in Eretz Israel that they could?
They've only got lands they've got rights to, but for them they don't own it yet. They can't have access to it unless it's been redeemed. That's the term goyla. They need redemption. Until they get redemption, they don't have access to it. It's in escrow. So they're gleaning from other people's fields.
Right. So they can't access it. So it's not theirs at all.
That's it.
And only their redeemer then gets to be the owner of the land.
And therefore, and especially if he redeems Ruth and she becomes the wife, Naomi and Ruth, they all get full access rights, civil rights to the land.
And then, so really, she's an heiress.
Everything's to play for. Everything. Think about what happens if this goes sour. Think about what happens if this goes south. And Boaz says, oh, for goodness sake, what was I thinking? She's going to lose everything. And stay in this predicament for the rest of her life.
Todd doesn't take her
either. Right. She's going to knock about in, you know.
And she's ruined her name.
That's right. She becomes worthless on the shidduch market. And no one's going to marry. Just like Tove thought, hold on, she's a Moabitess. It wasn't generally known you could marry a Moabitess. It was seen very bad luck, as it were, very bad fortune to have anything to do with Moab. Bichlal. It's like marrying a Nazi. Not only socially, but spiritually. No one's going to touch her with a disinfected barge pole. So unless this works out, it'll work out great if it does. But if it doesn't, the future's looking bleak.
Is that because the Moabites and the Ammonites were known as the products of incest?
The Torah has forbidden the Moabites to us for good reason, saying anything they touch goes sour. You touch them, you go sour. Now that's true for them and the men, but not the women. Because the women folk had nothing to do with not offering the Jews bread. Now, that was a little known fact that Boaz lit up and said, excuse me, if you look at the Sfarim clearly, it's only talking about Moabites, male, but the females are permitted, actually. So when he mentioned that to Tove, Tove was like, oh, okay, but still, you don't want a Moabite. You know, I don't want to lose my fortune to the Moabites. And what am I going to do too? Tell my wife I've just taken on a Moabite. Imagine I come home with a convert from the neo-Nazi brigade unannounced to my wife? Be like, where'd you get her? Oh, it was a dating site for the far right. Don't worry, she's from. It's not going to work. It's not going to work. That's going to be rough. Yeah, she comes with a lot of money. She's landed. I don't care. It's like I'm not interested. I ain't playing.
So Ellie Melech must have known about this with Mo by Tess, otherwise he wouldn't have let his sons marry them.
That's true and that's false. We know about that, but they weren't marrying people who had undergone a proper conversion. I don't care where you come from, that's not okay. Something was wrong there. As we discussed, that's when Omi says she was so embittered that she didn't do more to convince her husband not to allow this to happen. Now, while Elimelech was around, the boys weren't going to do this. While he was alive, they weren't. The second he was dead, they went straight to it.
So will Ruth need a conversion in order to marry Boaz?
She's already converted through Naomi. She's done a full conversion through Naomi. By this stage, she's fully Jewish.
So what, when she said, your God is my God, etc., etc., that was her part in her conversion.
But that was her conversion in love, not in fear. She converted in fear to marry Mahlon to look on paper that she was Jewish, but she only did so because she needed to for the marriage. So it's considered a sham conversion. She only converted properly when she started becoming weak out of struggling to keep up with Naomi, and Naomi realised the Eitah Hara is getting involved. This is a genuine conversion, and she's absolutely 100% stuck to Naomi. Rabbi Sai, we finished 3 out of 4 parokim. The fourth perek will go quite quickly because it's just tying up loose ends. Then, as I said in the beginning, I would like to do, with your permission, a synopsis of what's going on with David and Bathsheba. Because from what we've done here, we've touched upon Lot and his daughters, Yehuda and Tamar, and Rus and Boaz. It makes sense to wrap up David and Bathsheba so you've got the whole kit and caboodle. Is that okay? If you don't want to do it, we can skip it and start another, you know, Megillah. I don't mind if you say, no, we don't want that. But if you're happy to do that, it makes sense to have a David Bathsheba discussion to see how that mirrors everything that we got in. It's so connected, it would be the right place to do it. But
is that from Kings? Will that be from
Shmuel? We're going to be talking about it from Shmuel.
Yeah. Okay.
Okay, is that all right? Yeah. So again, so Baruch Hashem, I think we've done great. We've finished 3 out of 4. We've really cut. I mean, this is really good. I hope you can feel as if you're getting a much deeper appreciation of what's potting on Rus. I mean, this is really eye-opening, you know, as to see what's going on here. And we've still got a good few, really some wonderful ideas coming up in the fourth parak. Don't think it's all, you know, there's a couple of really beautiful ideas here, which are themes linking into what Boaz is saying. And the Chalitza ceremony. We've got the removing of the shoe and Yibum and all this business. What can we learn from Rus? There's a few really interesting things here. And then Tov, how he dealt with Tov, tells us how to deal in business with people. If you want to strike a deal, how to get it the deal your way. We learn out a lot of business acumen from the way Boaz dealt with Tov, who essentially was a competitor. And how he legally gave himself an advantage over his competitor because he felt spiritually he was the better redeemer, rusted as well. We'll learn that out as well. And Be'ez Hashem will finish the fourth parak. I'm looking forward to seeing you next week. Hope you have a wonderful week, a wonderful Shabbos. Any questions, I'm emailable. I look forward to seeing you then. Eri Etzlacha, Kol Tov. Shkoich to you. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Good Shabbos.
Shabbos.
Shabbos. Shabbos.